Hello, everybody. This is Daryl Lund from Community Bankers of Wisconsin. We'd like to welcome you to the CBW Godfrey & Kahn audio conference on the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act. We've got great attendance today with over 150 people joining us on today's call. So before I turn it over to Jim Sheriff and his team at Godfrey & Kahn, I have a few reminders to go over. The first is all phones are muted. And we will be opening up the phone lines at the end of the call for questions. At any time during the presentation, however, you have a call or a question that you'd like to ask and get it in the queue for the end of the conference call, you can send an email to info@communitybankers.org. Again, that's info@communitybankers.org. And we'll take those email questions at the end as well as opening up the phone lines. The second thing to know is that we did send out with our email for the call-in instructions the handouts for today's presentation. If, however, you do not have a copy of the handout, one is posted on the CBW website, which is communitybankers.org. Again, communitybankers.org. In the upper right-hand corner of our homepage, there is a you can download the presentation or follow along as the presentation is going. Finally, the last thing I wanted to reference is that this session is going to be recorded, and we will be posting the recording on our website shortly after the conference call. For those of you who have other bankers who are not able to participate, as well as board members, we will have an audio conference available. So again, we've got a lot of information to cover. I thank all of you for participating in today's call, and I'm going to turn it over to Jim Sheriff and his team at Godfrey & Kahn. So, Jim?
Daryl, thanks. We certainly appreciate the opportunity to talk with as many people who've signed up here today. We're thrilled to see that about the Dodd-Frank bill. What we've got a number of our colleagues who are each going to take some different aspects of the Dodd-Frank bill, try and dissect them here in really what's going to be, let's call it a college survey 101 overview course. We're certainly not on a 2,400-page bill that was signed into law a week ago. We're not going to get into all of the detail. We're going to instead focus on what we think really will impact community banks who are on the call here today, as much as other provisions. So the background of this bill is something you probably all experienced the last couple of years, starting with the meltdown and the economic collapse with Bear Stearns. Congress has been looking at passing legislation to affect the banking industry. And what we have, what they have come up with, that was just signed into law is something that all of you, all of us, are going to be dealing with for years to come in the services we're delivering. The bill, I hesitate to say that there's going to be much of a central theme about what we're going to talk about today. The bill is scattered, and it hits a lot of different things, ranging from interchange fees, which none of us 2 years ago would have thought had anything to do with an economic collapse, to mortgage lending, to the deposit side, to capital regulations. So who's ever around the table at all of your shops today, be they lenders, customer service reps, accountants, bank presidents, there will all be some parts of this that will impact you at varying times, because as you'll hear, this is going to be implemented over a period of the next couple of years. Many of you have probably heard that the act calls for about 250 new regulations to be published. So one of the first things that the industry is going to be dealing with is just a slug of probably every week new regulations to implement all of the parts of the law. In addition, there are 65 studies to be commissioned, ranging from should we permit arbitration in consumer loans to a variety of other things. So the regulators are going to be busier than ever. One other big thing in the bill that will, I think, have the biggest impact on community banks is going to be the presence of a new federal agency, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Pete Wilder is going to be talking about that, but here's a new agency with a $500 million plus budget annually and more than 1,000 employees. I know the community banks feel they may have dodged a bullet on this, but I think it's going to impact all of your lives. To finish the introduction, so loan and deposit taking activities, insurance premiums and your accounts are going to be affected. Corporate governance is going to be affected. Your bank's ability to branch into other states is affected by this. Particularly for federal thrifts and national banks, the idea of federal preemption of state laws is key and something we're going to address. One thing looking at this, community banks, we're going to keep saying dodged a bullet. This could have been much worse for the community banking industry. I think your Washington lobbyists, your lobbyists in Madison did an outstanding job in, as Daryl and I have talked, a lot of this was playing defense in your own red zone. This could have been way worse for capital, for standards, but there is a recognition for really the first time in this bill by Congress that community banks are very different than large money center banks. And there is a differentiation in the bill where banks with over $50 billion in assets, other companies that are going to be deemed systemically significant, are going to be the ones who are caught in a lot of the stuff we're not going to talk about today because it's not going to affect you. So in moving on to the first subject I wanted to talk about that's in the Dodd-Frank bill, and again, before that, there's some things I'm not going to mention. You probably heard a lot about proprietary trading, the Volcker Amendment, new limits on bank hedge funds. All of that stuff, half of the bill of the 2,500 pages, doesn't affect you. And all I'll say is whatever you've been doing in the past, you're going to continue to be able in those areas to keep doing. The first area, I think, of substantive restrictions you're going to see is in the residential mortgage lending area. And admittedly, these are going to be a little slow in coming. The new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is going to write rules over the next 18 months to 2 years. And much, obviously, of the last few years' focus with the crisis, if you will, was on subprime lending and mortgage lending. So one of the key aspects of this bill is to essentially re-regulate mortgage lending activities. And most everybody's not going to like this, I think, because what there is almost a duty of care, I would submit, that's going to be put on all bankers, doesn't matter what size, that you're going to have to do a more extensive job underwriting any mortgage loan and making sure that that applicant has a reasonable ability to repay the mortgage loan. To do that, the whole idea of no doc and low doc loans, they're going to be gone. There are going to be standards that you'll have to underwrite to that will the regulators are going to say and expand upon this law. What do you need to do to prove that you looked at John Doe's ability to repay and that you didn't steer him into a product that had predatory characteristics or effects? There's another zinger in here. So no one is quite sure what a loan with predatory characteristics or effects has. Again, you'll be doing much more in the underwriting process. And if you don't, you will have penalties now under the Truth in Lending Act for failure to properly underwrite that loan. That borrower will be able to use your failure to underwrite the loan to the standards you need to. They can use that as a defense in a foreclosure action and get money in a foreclosure action. There's other things in the mortgage regulations, ranging the belief that mortgage brokers were a big cause of this problem. Mortgage brokers and mortgage bankers really end up getting the raw end of the deal, I would say, in this legislation. There are no longer going to be yield spread premiums permitted for mortgage brokers as a way of compensating them. Just as an aside, the SAFE Act, not part of Dodd-Frank, but all of you involved in mortgage loan originations starting around January 1 are going to have to get new, you're going to have to get registered and get fingerprinted under a new, if you're a mortgage loan originator, and you will have a separate identifier number that will be used, that will go with you through the rest of your days if you're at other banks that are going to have to be on all loan application forms, et cetera. Finally, banks are going to have this new world of residential mortgage loans. However, you could say, I don't want the liabilities attendant with that. So we're going to just make what are going to be what are called qualified mortgages. For lack of a better term, on page 6 of my outline, some of the things that qualified mortgages will have, let's call them more plain vanilla mortgages. What Congress essentially is saying is, if you make really simple, straightforward mortgages that don't have any bells and whistles, that don't have negative amortization, that don't have a lot of features, that don't have more than 3 points total in fees and charges, then we're going to call that a qualified mortgage, and you won't have the type of liabilities later if someone says you didn't underwrite it properly. So my point to you in concluding on this section is that there'll be a lot of new rules that I think community banks should be active in reviewing over the next year and a half to 2 years, and there will be very significant changes in the whole mortgage lending process as a result. I'd like to next turn to John Reichert, my colleague.
Good afternoon. I'm going to discuss several changes related to FDIC insurance, deposit accounts, and the way certain of your bank subsidiaries will be examined. First, the formula for calculating FDIC assessments has changed. Historically, your assessment was based on your deposit base. Going forward, your FDIC assessment will be based on your bank's average total assets less average tangible equity. Many people feel that this will shift more of the burden for assessments away from community banks, which tend to be deposit rich, and shift it to the big banks, which have a lot of assets but not as many deposits. This change is effective now, but the FDIC still needs to publish regulations defining the new assessment procedures. In addition to those changes, there are 3 account level changes that will affect how your bank operates on a daily basis. First, as I'm sure most of you have heard, FDIC insurance levels have been permanently increased to $250,000, and that was effective July 21st of this year. Secondly, from December 31st of 2010 through January 1st of 2013, there will be no limit on FDIC insurance for all non-interest-bearing transaction accounts. This is very similar to the transaction account guarantee program that was put into place back in 2008. However, there are several important differences. First of all, while banks were able to opt out of the TAG program, all banks will be covered by this program going forward. Secondly, the TAG program covered IOLTA accounts, and it also covered certain low-interest NOW accounts. After December 31st of this year, IOLTA accounts and low-interest NOW accounts will no longer have unlimited FDIC insurance. And thirdly, in the past, only the banks that had opted to remain in the TAG program were responsible for the assessments related to the additional insurance. Going forward, after December 31st, since all banks will be covered, all banks will also be assessed on all of these deposits. Thirdly, beginning July 21st, 2011, banks will be allowed to pay interest on checking accounts. This is a big development. We think the consequences of this change could be numerous. Among them, it means that Regulation Q is essentially gone. A piece that we're particularly interested to see how it unfolds is the effect that this will have on Eurodollar sweeps, the Cayman Island branch product that a lot of larger banks offer, repurchase sweeps, and earnings credits, because all three of those products developed and evolved as a way to basically pay interest on business checking balances, and now they may no longer be necessary. We also think that the cost of funds for community banks are going to go up, as everyone will now probably be required to pay interest on business checking balances in order to remain competitive. At the same time, it's going to be interesting to see which is more important to business customers, interest or insurance, because they can't have both. So they can either have unlimited FDIC insurance on their balances, or they can start to earn some interest on their balances, but they'll have to, the marketplace will tell us which is more important. So that's something you guys will certainly have to think about and be aware of as we move towards July 21st next year. The last insurance piece involves changes to the Deposit Insurance Fund. The reserve has historically been capped at 1.5% of all covered deposits. Going forward, the reserve will no longer be capped. The FDIC will also no longer be required to refund any excess amounts that are in the Deposit Insurance Fund to the banks as it had been in the past. By September 30th of 2020, so they have a full 10 years to do this, the minimum reserve ratio must be 1.35%, and the FDIC will be required to look to big banks, those banks with assets greater than $10 billion, to fund all amounts over 1.15%. So again, what that means is over the next 10 years, all banks are going to be required to replenish the fund such that it gets to 1.15% of the deposit base, and then the FDIC is going to have to look to those banks over $10 billion to bring the reserve ratio up to 1.35%. It's going to be interesting. We think it's going to be interesting to see how assessments work out, because while the method for calculating assessments has changed, there will also be a lot more deposits that are now going to be covered by the Deposit Insurance Fund, at least through January 1st of 2013, and that assumes that the unlimited insurance portion is not extended beyond that date. So that covers the main changes to the FDIC insurance coverage, the way the assessments will be calculated, and the way the Deposit Insurance Fund will be managed. The other piece I'm going to talk very briefly about is a change in the way non-bank subsidiaries will be examined. For those of you with copies of our slides, there's a lot of information on slide 8 regarding this topic. But basically, if you have non-bank subsidiaries, such as a Nevada subsidiary, a mortgage subsidiary, insurance subsidiary, etc., the Federal Reserve or one of the other federal regulators, the FDIC or the OCC, if they're delegated, will be examining those subsidiaries as well as the bank. And the purpose is they want to make sure that any bank subsidiaries are operated in a safe and sound manner so as to not threaten the parent bank. So that will be another change that you'll have going forward, is your exams will be a little more robust than they've been in the past, and they won't be limited to just the bank and the bank's activities. I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Pete Wilder, who's going to talk about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
Thanks, John, and good afternoon, everybody. Jim alluded to this a little bit earlier, but I think this new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau will probably have a bigger effect on community banks than really anything else in this act. It's a new executive agency, and it's going to be housed within the Federal Reserve System. A new director is going to be appointed by the president, has to be confirmed by the Senate, and that director will have a 5-year term. You may have heard Elizabeth Warren, the Harvard law professor, is kind of in the running right now for that, but there's a number of other people who are, some folks are speculating, may be appointed to that position. Obviously, the new director is going to have an immense amount of influence on how the Bureau gets operated for the next number of years. The Bureau is going to be pretty large. In the first year, it's going to have between $400 million and $600 million for a budget, with an additional $200 million in supplemental appropriations available. And that all adds up to about 10% of the Federal Reserve System's operating budget. So this is a significant new executive agency to be dealt with here. The Bureau is now going to be responsible for federal consumer financial laws. So they are essentially all the laws that you would expect a new financial protection agency to be responsible for. I'm talking about Truth in Lending, RESPA, HMDA, the SAFE Act, FCRA, Truth in Savings. And they're going to have jurisdiction over what the statute or the act calls covered persons. And a covered person is essentially anyone engaged in offering or providing consumer financial products or services. So that is anyone extending credit, taking deposits, cashing checks, offering real estate settlement services, collecting debts, et cetera. There are a few notable carve-outs. The news focused on auto dealers, they've been carved out. Real estate brokers were carved out. Accountants, lawyers are just a few of the folks who've been carved out of the jurisdiction of the new Bureau here. The most significant thing to watch out for community banks at least, is the broad rulemaking authority now that the Bureau has over federal consumer protection laws. So again, I'm talking, you know, Truth in Lending, RESPA, ECOA, SAFE Act. These are all going to be within the responsibility of the Bureau, both the existing regulations they'll have authority over as well as creating new regulations. And in addition to that, they're given the authority to create new rules prohibiting unfair, deceptive, and abusive practices by covered persons. This could potentially be a thorn in the side of the industry for years to come here, only because it gives extremely broad authority to the Bureau to create a number of new laws and regulations here. And again, the statute or the act attempts to define what an unfair, deceptive, and abusive practice is. And basically, it's a bit of a squishy standard, but gives the opportunity for the Bureau to interpret it quite liberally and be able to come up with quite a few new rules and regulations. The Act explicitly requires at least 24 new rules by the Bureau, as well as 4 one-time reports or studies and an additional 5 new periodic reports. So you'll see that the Bureau is going to be quite busy from the start. And again, that's just a start. There'll be additional rules and regulations that are going to come out from the Bureau as years pass here. The Bureau does have exemptive authority, so it'll be able to exempt certain classes of covered persons and classes of financial products from its rules. The next important piece to mention for the Bureau here is its supervision and enforcement authority. So again, the Bureau has exclusive rulemaking authority over financial protection laws. It also has some supervision and enforcement authority. There are 3 different groups of covered persons here that we need to think about. One is non-depository covered persons. So for example, mortgage brokers or payday lenders. Bureau will have exclusive examination authority over non-depository covered persons, as well as exclusive enforcement authority. Then the second group is banks that are over $10 billion in total assets. The Bureau will have exclusive examination authority over them, as well as primary enforcement authority. Large banks can still have enforcement actions brought by their prudential regulator. Their prudential regulator will have backup authority. And finally, and more interesting for the folks probably on this call, are banks under $10 billion. For those banks, the Bureau can require reports and can require some sampling and examinations, but they don't actually examine you. Your prudential regulator is going to continue to examine you on these financial protection laws. But again, may have dodged a bullet in that sense, but the Bureau is still going to have some ability to have a little bit of influence if they want to have that influence. And secondly, with respect to enforcement, the Bureau can recommend enforcement actions to your prudential regulator, but those enforcement actions have to be brought by your current regulator, not by the Bureau. So again, you'll hear a lot of folks say that community banks dodged a bullet here by not having examinations or enforcement actions brought by this new agency. However, the reality is, I think, that the Bureau, to the extent it wants to have additional influence, has the ability to have that additional influence. And also the reality is your regulators now are going to be looking to the Bureau and how the Bureau is enforcing the consumer protection laws and looking at their examination procedures for those rules and regulations too. The Bureau is going to essentially take over its functions on what the Act calls the designated transfer date. That date will be sometime between January 18th of 2011 and January 23rd of 2012. We don't know the exact date yet, but the Secretary of the Treasury is going to have to designate that date by September 19th of this year. So as of September 19th, not too far off, we'll know exactly when the Bureau is going to pick up its authority. Finally, I just want to mention a few miscellaneous matters that I think are probably of interest here. One is arbitration. The Bureau is now going to have the ability to prohibit or limit pre-dispute arbitration provisions after conducting a study on them. I mention this only because arbitration tends to be a hot topic and has been for quite some time, and a lot of forms have arbitration clauses in them. Secondly, there's some significant civil penalties for violations of consumer financial laws. It's up to $5,000 a day for any violation, up to $25,000 a day for any reckless violations, and up to $1 million a day for knowing violations. Those penalties can be enforced either in administrative forums or in court proceedings. Finally, I want to mention a couple things about Truth in Lending and RESPA. The Truth in Lending coverage threshold is now going to be increased to $50,000. Right now it's $25,000, and when the designated transfer date occurs, that limit will increase to $50,000. There'll be annual adjustments every January to that number as well for inflation, and I think at least in Wisconsin we should expect or anticipate that the Wisconsin Consumer Act may have a corresponding change to increase its coverage from $25,000 to $50,000. And finally, I know everyone's probably frustrated still over the implementation of the new GFE and some of the other RESPA rules, and you may be relieved or further frustrated to know that this new rule now calls for a combination of RESPA and Truth in Lending disclosures. So whereas you just maybe went through quite a bit of implementation and cost for compliance, within a couple of years, we're likely going to have a new disclosure form. So with that, I want to pass it over to Tom Homburg, who's going to take up our next topic here.
Well, thanks, Peter. Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to talk this afternoon about three topics. First of all, the elimination of the Office of Thrift Supervision, the new limitations on the scope of federal preemption, and finally, the removal of restrictions on interstate branching. For those of you who are following the outline, my discussion begins on page 11. Let's first talk about the OTS. As widely expected, within approximately 12 to 18 months following the enactment of Dodd-Frank, the OTS will be eliminated. The agency, along with most of its staff, will be transferred and merged into the OCC. And this is, again, is not a particular surprise. The OTS really has been subject to a firestorm of criticism over the past 2 years over its role in some of the largest bank failures in U.S. history, including IndyMac Bank out of California, which I believe to date has cost the insurance fund over $10 billion, by far the largest loss ever, as well as the failure of Washington Mutual Bank, which by assets has the dubious distinction of being the largest failure ever. So a lot of criticism, unfortunately, with the OTS. Now, it's important to point out, however, that although the agency will disappear, the thrift charter itself will survive, and the powers of the OTS will be transferred and divided among three existing regulatory agencies. And in particular, the OCC will now have supervisory and rulemaking authority over federal thrifts, as well as rulemaking authority for state chartered thrifts. And then on the federal level, the FDIC will take over the supervision of state chartered thrifts. And then finally, the Federal Reserve will now have responsibility for the supervision and regulation of thrift holding companies and their non-depository subsidiaries, as well as rulemaking in certain select areas, including affiliate transactions, loans to insiders, and the anti-tying prohibitions. I think the question that for state and federal thrifts is what effect are these changes, the elimination of the OTS and the other changes in Dodd-Frank, what effect are they going to have on me? I think as an initial matter, a number of people in the industry have begun to question whether there's any significant advantages remaining anymore to the Federal Thrift Charter. Historically, there's been really two primary advantages to this charter. It's been the much broader preemption rights that federal thrifts have vis-a-vis national banks, as well as the ability to expand on an interstate basis without state law restrictions. However, as I'll talk about a little later, these restrictions have essentially been eliminated. And with the additional compliance burden of the qualified thrift lender test, I would not be surprised if we start to see a number of institutions reexamining whether this is the proper charter for them, and we may start to see some conversions over the next couple of years, whether that may be to a state thrift charter or to a commercial bank charter. In addition to these elimination of these historic advantages, obviously the supervisory environment is going to change. And while many of the people that you may be working with may simply be transferred over to the respective agencies, I think it's fair to say that you can expect heightened regulatory oversight and scrutiny, especially from the OCC or the FDIC. And then finally, for those institutions with holding companies, now all of a sudden you have another regulator to deal with, and that's the Federal Reserve. And obviously this is going to result in additional compliance burdens. So I think ultimately all these changes combined are going to make a much more challenging regulatory environment for federal and state thrifts for years to come. I'd like to switch gears and briefly talk about federal preemption. This clearly was one of the most contentious issues during the debate over Dodd-Frank, and is an issue that is particularly important for large institutions with multi-state operations. What I can tell you is a lot of lobbying, money, and effort was spent during the process in trying to preserve the scope of preemption. And we're already seeing the political fallout over this debate. Just last week, the U.S. Department of Treasury, in a somewhat unusual move, announced that Julie Williams, who's the deputy controller at the OCC, the number two person, that she would not be selected to head the agency. Somewhat unusual to announce who you're not going to select versus you're going to select. And she was really viewed as the front runner for the position, given the fact that she had twice served as an acting controller, was well respected in banking circles and within the agency itself. However, apparently she's burned some bridges with the administration, and this really appears to be retaliation for her role in trying to preserve the scope of federal preemption. So what effect will the preemption standards have on community banks? To be fair, this was not a hot-button issue for the community banking industry as a whole. Unless you have our federal charter with multi-state operations, it's unlikely that preemption is important to your deposit and loan platform. However, what I would say is I think it's important to understand the new limits on preemption because the effect that it's going to have on your competitors. What I can tell you is that there's a lot of institutions out there that are very concerned about the potential fallout related to these new preemption rules. Now, for those of you that have been following preemption, over the past 15 years or so, the courts and regulators have not only upheld, consistently upheld federal preemption, but there's really been a steady expansion of the scope of federal preemption, including the expansion of preemption to operating subsidiaries of federal charters, the expansion of preemption to agents of federal thrift, so not even employees, but agents. By some counts, I've heard that there's been 277 court cases dealing with federal preemption, and four of those were significant Supreme Court decisions. So there's been a lot of litigation in this area. Dodd-Frank will effectively halt the expansion of federal preemption. As a starting point, federal preemption for operating subsidiaries has been eliminated, effective immediately, and the preemption ruling on agents of thrifts has been effectively nullified as well. With respect to banks, the industry did score victory, and Dodd-Frank does not override existing Supreme Court standards for preemption. And in particular, what those standards are is that what's known as a state consumer financial law may only be preempted to the extent that it prevents or significantly interferes with the exercise of a national bank or thrift power. And again, this is consistent with Supreme Court precedent, namely in a well-known case called Barnett Bank versus Nelson. However, the devil's really in the details. And what the Act does is it imposes a number of procedural requirements that really is going to make it a lot more difficult for an agency or a court to make a preemption determination. And in particular, the OCC, obviously the regulator for national banks and the regulator for federal thrifts moving forward, may only make a preemption determination on a case-by-case basis. It can no longer issue broad preemptive rulings. The past precedent on occupying the field and covering wide areas of state deposit or loan laws is no longer appropriate. Additionally, the OCC must periodically review these determinations through a formal administrative notice and review process, which must occur at least once every 5 years. The OCC must publish quarterly a list of its preemption determinations. And then finally, the standard of legal review by a court has been modified to encourage greater judicial scrutiny of agency preemption determinations. The conventional wisdom is that as a result of these subtle but rather important changes, that state attorney generals are going to feel empowered, emboldened to take a much more aggressive stance in enforcing state consumer laws. And what is particularly important for the industry and troubling is that these rules are effective immediately. That in turn raises a number of issues, including can a bank rely on existing regulations and interpretations? If it can't, systems, loan documents need to be changed yesterday. And it's also unclear what laws constitute a state consumer financial law. Theoretically, one could argue that a licensing law, a unfair and deceptive trade practices statute, an advertising law does not apply to these new preemption standards. So unfortunately, we have a lot of ambiguity here and uncertainty. But if there is one certainty that I can tell you is that there's going to be a lot of litigation in for years to come over the scope of these rules and the scope of preemption. Real briefly, the last topic I'd like to talk about is interstate branching. As you're, I'm sure, aware, historically, as a result of the 1994 Regal-Neal Act, banks generally have been limited in their ability to establish branches outside of their home state without acquiring a whole institution, although in recent years a number of states, including Wisconsin, have adopted what's known as reciprocity laws to provide limited branching rights. Well, effective immediately, Dodd-Frank has eliminated these branching restrictions. Banks are free to establish branches in any state if, under the laws of the state where the branch would be located, a state charter bank would be permitted to establish a branch. This may result in opportunities for Wisconsin banks, which can now expand into states such as Iowa and Minnesota, which currently do not permit branching. On the flip side, it may also result in increased competition as banks branch into Wisconsin. Right now, since there's very little expansion going on, it's hard to evaluate this, but I think long term, this could become a significant issue for community banks. With that, I'm a little over my time, so I'll turn the floor over to Patrick Murphy.
Thanks, Tom, and good afternoon, everyone. I'm going to talk about a veritable grab bag of issues here, miscellaneous things. I'm going to start by talking about some minimum leverage and risk-based capital standards. Then I'll switch over to some executive comp issues related both to public as well as non-public financial institutions. I'm going to touch on some changes to the accredited investor standards for private placement offerings, and then wrap up with some corporate governance issues and Sarbanes-Oxley changes. So if you'd like to turn to slide 15 of your slide deck, we'll start by talking about the minimum leverage and risk-based capital standards, otherwise known as the, you know, affectionately called the Collins Amendment. This was introduced into the bill by Senator Susan Collins out of Maine at the urging of Sheila Bair, the chairwoman of the FDIC. And when it was first introduced, this really struck fear into the hearts of most bankers because it really had the potential of creating a whole series of undercapitalized bank holding companies virtually overnight. Fortunately, a lot of the bugs and oversights in the original draft of the amendment were worked out during the conference committee. And community banks really kind of, you know, not to use an overused phrase here, but dodged a bullet on this one because it could have been a lot worse for them. But I'll talk about that in a minute. I just want to talk about first what the two primary impacts of this amendment are. And the first is that the federal regulators need to establish minimum leverage and risk-based capital requirements at both financial institutions as well as their holding companies, and that needs to be done by January of 2012. the standards will be, you know, fleshed out in the rule writing process. However, what we do know is that they cannot be lower than the standards currently applicable to financial institutions under prompt corrective action guidelines. And they can't be lower than what they currently are. So what do we know from this? We know that, you know, at the very best, your capital requirements are going to remain unchanged. And at the worst, and more likely scenario is that they're going to increase. I mean, I'm sure a lot of you have come out of exams with directives from regulators saying you need to raise your capital, that, you know, 8 is the new 6 and 12 is the new 10. I wouldn't be surprised to see some of that get fleshed out in the rule writing here. The other piece issue that is implicated by this particular amendment is that kind of the phase out of what we refer to as hybrid capital instruments. And what I'm talking about here are primarily trust preferred securities type investment vehicles. They're basically investment vehicles that look a lot like debt, but they're treated as permanent capital or semi-permanent capital for regulatory capital purposes. These obviously have had some disfavor as of late, particularly by the FDIC, and so the Dodd-Frank Act has gone the step of actually trying to phase these out over time for certain institutions. There's really, you know, like so many provisions of the Act, there's kind of a disparate treatment of institutions depending on not only their size but also their charter flavor. So there's really two magic numbers here. One is $500 million and the other is $15 billion. And the $500 million is really implicated by the Fed's policy statement for small bank holding companies. Under that policy statement, a bank holding company is considered to be a small bank holding company and can avail themselves of that policy statement if they have combined assets of $500 million or less. And I suspect that really applies to a lot of our listeners right now. And for the most part, what you need to know is that you basically kind of escaped the clutches of the at least the bank holding company side of the provisions of this particular amendment, because you're exempted. The fear was initially that the small bank holding company exemptions would go away, but that was, like I said, fleshed out in the conference committee, and so that has been preserved. And so under those particular provisions, you don't need to comply with the Federal Reserve's capital requirements as long as you're under that $500 million threshold, and you will continue not to have to comply with those. What that means for you is that you have more flexibility in terms of the type of capital instruments that you can use to raise capital at your institution without having to kind of, you know, be very careful about how you structure the instruments so that you comply and fit them into Tier 1 capital. Because, of course, as you inject the capital from the holding company into the bank, it becomes Tier 1 at the bank, which is where the new provisions will apply to you. As far as how this all gets rolled out, I guess I would urge you to look at the matrix that I have set out on slide 15. This really kind of breaks it down by institution size and by charter flavor. And let's just walk through that real briefly here. As far as, you know, we discussed, the bank holding companies with assets under $500 million are exempt from the provisions by virtue of the small bank holding company policy statement. If your asset size is over $500 million but less than $15 billion, basically any instruments, any hybrid instruments such as trust preferred securities that you issued prior to May 19th of 2010 will be grandfathered in at the level that they currently apply to Tier 1 capital right now. And as you may recall, the you know, currently trust preferred securities can count for as much as 25% of your total Tier 1 capital, and they will continue to do so if they're issued prior to May 19th of 2010. And I highly suspect that you have not issued any trust preferred securities since May 19th of 2010, since that market is essentially dried up at this point. With respect to the minimum, the new minimum leverage and risk-based capital requirements, those will, in essence, go into effect as soon as the rules have been passed. So, you know, we have a little bit of time there, basically until January of 2012, but look for that. You know, look for those notice of proposed rulemaking, because it'll be important for you to make some comments on those, you know, based on your perception of how it's going to impact your organization. For bank holding companies with assets in excess of $15 billion, which I suspect there are very few, if any, callers or listeners on the line right now, the hybrid capital instruments such as trust preferreds will be phased out between 2013 and 2016. So there's a little bit of time to replace that capital with more permanent equity. And once again, the minimum leverage and risk-based capital requirements will apply to them upon enactment of the final rule. It's a little bit different for the thrifts. And I have to correct one of the boxes on the matrix here. The thrift holding companies with assets less than $15 billion are actually grandfathered in, similar to the bank holding companies. So where it says exempt, you should actually put in there grandfathered if issued before May 19th, 2010. There is no exemption for thrifts under $500 million because they're not subject to the policy statement. So essentially, thrifts are treated as if, you know, the under $15 billion and over $15 billion. They're applied essentially the same way as bank holding companies are. Mutual holding companies are grandfathered in if the instrument was issued prior to May 19th of 2010. For all thrifts and mutual holding companies, thrift holding companies and mutual holding companies, the new minimum leverage and risk-based capital requirements are not effective until January of 2015. So you actually have a little extra time there. I'd like to move on now to slide 16, which is gonna just briefly talk about some executive compensation provisions that are applicable to institutions, regardless of whether they're public institutions or not. In essence, what these provisions are requiring is that the regulators come up with guidelines that prohibit incentive compensation systems that promote risk-taking or risky behavior by way of offering excessive compensation to their executive officers. The other piece of this is that institutions that are covered under this are basically going to be required to report what their incentive-based compensation systems are to the federal regulators. Now, who's covered by this? Specifically, institutions with assets over $1 billion are covered. However, what I would suggest is that, like a lot of the other provisions of the Act, there's probably some best practices to be taken out of this, and shareholders may be looking towards, you know, the larger institutions to see what, you know, the smaller institutions really should be doing. How do they define excessive compensation? Well, they really refer back to the FDIA, and there are certain provisions in the FDIA that talk about the types of standards that should be considered in determining whether compensation is excessive, including such things as the value of all cash and non-cash benefits provided to the executive officer, the compensation history of for the executive officer, the financial condition of the institution, and other things like that that are generally pretty intuitive. So there's really not a ton of change here other than it's being codified in a little more formal fashion. With respect to the disclosure provisions of this, well, again, the devil's going to be in the details of the rule writing here, but essentially I would expect this to look a lot like the provisions that are applicable to TARP recipients right now in terms of reporting their executive compensation systems. So you might want to look to that to see exactly what would be required. I'm going to move on to slide 17 now and talk real briefly about some accredited investor standards that changed by virtue of the Act. As you may or may not know, accredited investors are implicated in private placement offerings, essentially where you are limited to the number of quote-unquote non-accredited investors that you can offer to and avail yourself of that exemption under the securities laws. Once again, this is a provision that could have ended up a lot worse than it really did. There was some talk about really substantially increasing the income thresholds to qualify as an accredited investor. But in essence, what happened was the net worth standard was the only thing that really changed. And it wasn't the dollar amount that changed per se, but what happened was they decided to define the net worth to exclude the individual's primary residence. As I'm sure you can speculate, a lot of individuals have a fair amount of their net worth tied up in their primary residence, so this potentially has a significant impact. However, I will say that you only have to qualify for an accredited investor under one of the standards, and so the fact that you don't qualify under the net worth standard doesn't mean you will be disqualified under the income standards, which did not change. I think this is an area that we need to look at right away, because I know that there are a number of institutions out there that have public offerings underway right now, or private offerings underway right now, that rely on accredited investors as their target. To the extent that you have subscription agreements that you've taken in that have not been accepted yet, and you know, most subscription agreements have check boxes that indicate how the particular subscriber qualifies as an accredited investor, I would suggest you go back and look at those and see if there are any in there that rely exclusively on the net worth standard. And if that's the case, then I would suggest that you actually go out and get that subscriber to recertify as to their accredited status under the new rules. I think our position is that, as far as we're concerned, any subscriptions that have been received, accepted, countersigned, we would view those as being grandfathered in under the old rules, so we wouldn't expect you to have to go back and re-accreditate those investors. I want to move on to some provisions that are applicable to smaller public companies, and I'm going to do this real briefly, but on page 18, if you look there, we're talking about some provisions that are applicable to all SEC registrants, all companies who are registered under the Securities Act. And there are a couple of them that will take effect without any further rule writing, and those are at the top of the slide there, including say on pay, which, you know, gives the shareholders a non-binding vote on executive compensation, say on golden parachutes, which is applicable to executive parachute payments, on merger votes, and then some pay and performance disclosure and pay equity disclosures that are actually subject to further rule writing. There's some provisions that are applicable only to listed companies, and when we refer to listed companies, we're talking about exchange-traded companies, which does not include over-the-counter bulletin board companies or pink sheet-traded companies. And those relate to the independence of compensation committee members. It talks about establishing some standards for hiring compensation consultants and providing some provisions for clawbacks of incentive-based compensation in the event that financial statements need to be reissued. I won't say a lot more on that because I think, you know, it's a limited audience that would be applied to. Some corporate governance provisions that are applicable again to bank holding companies with assets over $10 billion. In particular, there's a requirement that those institutions have risk committees. I would suggest that this is probably a good best practices thing to keep in mind for your institution, not only from a investor standpoint, but also from a regulatory standpoint and really just a good operating standpoint. So that's something to consider. There are some rules that need to be written to basically allow access of certain shareholders to the company's proxy statement for purposes of nominating directors. And then there's also some rules that need to be written to basically allow provide that companies need to disclose in their proxy statements why they think it's necessary for their chairman and their CEO to either be at one combined position or two separate positions. I'll close real briefly on an item that's under Sarbanes-Oxley, Rule 404, which basically was the attestation of internal controls by your external auditors. Smaller reporting companies, that is companies with a public float of $75 million or less, have been subject to kind of a rolling exemption on this. what the Dodd-Frank Act did was basically make that a permanent exemption. So those companies no longer have to worry about having their outside auditors attest to internal control standards. With that, I'm way over my time, so I'm going to throw the baton back over to Jim Sheriff to wrap up here.
Thanks, Pat. I'm just going to briefly talk about something, and then we'll start taking some questions and conclude here. My final subject is one of interchange fees, and this is something that sort of came out of the blue, as I mentioned earlier. I don't think anyone had anticipated an amendment by Senator Durbin of Illinois that is going to have the Federal Reserve Board by March of this year publish a rule that will essentially dictate what a reasonable and proportional debit card interchange fee is. So it's really price controls in the transactional exchange world here. Community banks are exempted because small banks with less than $10 billion of assets will not be covered by this rule. But I think the bankers have appropriately figured out that prices are going to be set by competition in the marketplace. And if all of the larger banks are going to now be regulated and restricted on what they can charge, that's really going to have an impact on your fees. And I think everyone is predicting that interchange fees from community banks on up are going to be reduced. Some of you may have seen a few days ago, I think the Senate is now considering even legislation that would put fee restrictions on credit card interchange. So between overdrafts, interchange, and credit cards, your community banks are losing a lot of sources of your regular revenue. Well, in any event, so that's on the interchange fees. In concluding, I think what we have presented is a brave new world of all of you out there. There is going to be a lot of learning necessary. Boy, between the health care bill and this, there is 5,000 pages of new federal law. It's not going to be overnight, but this is going to be a course of years that this all comes in, much of it, as we said, in the form of rulemaking. So we hope to stand ready to help the community banks get more acquainted with any of the detail of these rules. If you thought this was helpful, we've told Daryl we'd be happy to do some more of these and drive down into the detail. I know Daryl is looking forward to working with the group with the banks to, as I say, continue to be an active part of the rulemaking process to assure that community banks will continue to be distinctly different and have a role going forward. Daryl?
Thanks, Jim, and thanks to everybody for the presentations. And again, thanks for everybody listening on. We're now running up to our time, but we will be able to stay on for a few minutes after one to answer any questions. What I'm going to do right now is unmute all of the lines. If you do not have a question, I'd ask that you would press #1 on your phone. Again, #1, which will keep you in a mute mode so that we don't have a lot of outside distractions. And you can always press #2 to unmute your line if you need to ask a question. I'm going to, before I unmute them, if you have to get off the call, I'm going to just wait a couple seconds here, allow you to hang up, and then so we don't have a lot of people hanging up at once when I unmute. So I'm going to wait just about 5 seconds here, and then we're going to unmute all the lines. Okay, the call is open now. If question, that you state your name and bank, and we'll see if we can answer it. So. Open line right now. Any questions from the group?
Trevor Bowen, United Bank. You had a ban on yield spread premiums for mortgage brokers. We currently do have the ability in which to sell to servicing release, which are income comes in as a servicing yield spread premium. How are they going to handle that going forth?
I think that's going to be, we're going to have to wait for rule writing from what I can tell. I don't know, Peter, if you have any thought on that. I think it essentially says that, you know, there are going to have to be rules that will not permit mortgage brokers to be paid based on any formula that has, what am I trying to say here, that has a variable in it. So, for example, I mean, if you were going to pay a mortgage broker more, or a mortgage broker would make more if they have a higher rate loan, that is going to be banned. But I have to confess, I don't know, not having seen how the rules are going to work on that.
Other questions from the group?
I have a question. This is Linda Bollig from State Bank of Cross Plains.
Okay, Linda, go ahead.
Relative to the interchange fee, the impact that will have on the debit card transactions. My question is when someone utilizes their debit card, you know, they have a choice of either selecting debit versus credit. Does that have an impact on whether or not, I guess what I'm trying, in my mind, I'm trying to identify, you know, it's still a debit card that they're using, but does it make a difference by choosing debit versus credit?
Well, one thing on that, Linda, and I didn't mention, but on my slide, the Act is going to permit merchants for the first time now to discriminate based on the type of card that is being used. So they'll be able to ask if it's debit or credit and only accept one or the other.
Okay.
And also they're going to be able to set minimum payment amounts on acceptance of cards. And I'm not an expert on this, but I believe don't the card association rules currently prohibit that, the merchants from putting, so I think all that interface with customers, merchants are going to have more power and to kind of take the kind of card they want or not take a certain card. I don't know if anyone around the table has another thought on it, but is that something, Linda, do you see this as significantly reducing or reducing your bank's income?
To some extent, but, you know, I guess that remains to be seen based on what ends up happening with the bigger banks as far as setting the interchange.
Yeah, well, and one of those is there was quite a debate over whether the bigger banks said, you've got to let us include the costs of our fraud platform and the costs of fraud. That has to be part of our costs that we are going to match, and that was permitted. So, but I think all of this, the big banks are very active right now in trying to get data and working on this.
The interchange fees for credit cards versus debit card options.
Jim Sheriff, this is Jim Tubbs from the State Bank as well. And in regards to Linda's question, do you know, is there going to be also a disparity between if it's PIN related compared to a signature base?
I don't know, Jim. I don't know the answer to that. I would see that developing that way, though. I mean, I think there's going to be, I think merchants are going to be more empowered to get the best deal. The view being that they were, they needed protection here. So I think there could be distinctions on that.
Right. So it's just an overview of what you may eventually come out correct. Yeah.
Any more questions coming in?
Other questions from the group? This is Daryl. I think, as Jim and others alluded to, this is a, particularly in the debit interchange, the fees, that was one of our most troubling provisions that was included in there. And obviously we're going to be watching very closely as the Federal Reserve does their rulemaking process over the coming months, and hopefully that the final rule that comes out will be less onerous, but it was something that was very troubling for the entire industry to have that part of it. Any other questions from the group?
Hi, I have one if we're still open for it.
Sure, go ahead.
Tom Dateen with Investors Community Bank. Just on slide number seven, you talk about the deposit insurance fund and the removal of the cap and the 135 by the, September of 2020. What is the level right now? Do you have a sense as to what that percentage is as we stand today?
It's a negative number, but I don't know what the current percentage is.
Okay.
That was part of the reason for the prepayment was to increase.
Oh, last
the,
year?
Yeah.
But even with the prepayment, it's a negative number as of today.
Right.
It's a little confusing, though, because what the FDIC does is it kind of allocates for banks on the troubled list an amount under that fund. And so it's just an accounting error entry right now. I mean, they actually have, tens of billions of dollars in the fund. They've just allocated it for institutions on the list, on the troubled bank list.
Other questions from the group? As I mentioned, the PowerPoint is on our website, communitybankers.org. This session has been recorded, so if you would like to obtain a recording of this to give to other employees or your directors at some point, we'll have that available here shortly. But I'll open up one more last time. Any other questions from the group?
Darryl,
if not, I would like to first off thank Jim Sheriff, Godfrey Khan, and all of his colleagues for the information. And I appreciate everybody's time here over the noon hour to listen to this. Obviously, as Jim said, this is a kind of a starting point because there's a lot of rulemaking and other things that will be coming as a result of this Dodd-Frank Act, and we'll be monitoring closely and keeping all of you apprised of it. But thank everybody for this, and have a good day.
Make sure it's off.